in the limelight. According to Pedro Halal, an eminent epidemiologist who is leading the first study to quantify the scale of Brazil's COVID disaster, the country could have saved 400,000 lives if the government had implemented stricter social distancing measures and launched a vaccination program earlier. We'll prepare for you an article written by Flavia Milhorens under the heading, Brazil suspends Covaxin contract after serious charges of irregularities. Brazil's Health Minister, Marcelo Quiroga, announced on Tuesday, 29th of June, that his country will suspend the $324 million Indian COVID-19 vaccine contract that has mired President Jair Bolsonaro in charges of irregularities. The deal to buy 20 million doses of Bharat Biotech's Covaxin shot has become a headache for Jair Bolsonaro after whistleblowers went public with charged irregularities. A former employee at the health ministry recently told the prosecutor's office that he told the president that he was pressured to sign a contract that would increase the average price of vaccine doses by as much as 1,000%. Jair Bolsonaro, whose popularity has faded as Brazil's COVID-19 death toll climbed past 500,000, has denied any wrongdoing, saying on Monday, 28th of June, that he was not aware of any irregularities. But thorny questions refuse to go away and may pose problems for him in the run-up to next year's presidential election. The Brazilian Health Minister, Marcelo Quiroga, said at a news conference his team would investigate the charges during the suspension. The Health Ministry claimed in a statement, according to a preliminary analysis, there are no irregularities in the contract, but for compliance, the health ministry chose to suspend the contract. Brazilian federal prosecutors have opened an investigation into the deal, citing comparatively high prices, quick talks and pending regulatory approvals as red flags. It is also being scrutinized by a Senate panel investigating the government's handling of the pandemic. At a hearing on Friday, 25th of June, Luis Ricardo Miranda, head of imports at the Brazilian Health Ministry, told senators he refused to approve an import license because an invoice for a first shipment asked for upfront payment and was sent by a company not mentioned in the contract. Brazilian government officials have denied any irregularity in the contract and said that the whistleblower's claims would be investigated. One of the leading opposition senators on that panel filed a formal criminal complaint against President Jair Bolsonaro at the Brazilian Supreme Court on Monday, 28th of June. Senator Randolph Rodriguez said he wanted the court to investigate the serious charges and to find out why Jair Bolsonaro did not take any action after being notified of the existence of a giant corruption scheme in the health ministry. Meanwhile, according to an eminent epidemiologist who is leading the first study to quantify the scale of Brazil's COVID disaster, the country could have saved as many as 400,000 lives if the government had implemented stricter social distancing measures and launched a vaccination program much earlier. Pedro Halal, a professor at the Federal University of Pelotas, said such policies would have prevented 80% of the 500,000 COVID deaths registered in one of the hardest hit countries in the world. Pedro Halal told the Guardian newspaper, "The responsibility for these numbers is entirely on the federal government's back, and particularly on the president's." Pedro Halal said, "It was not the federal government who said that the pandemic was a little flu. It was not the government that encouraged people to go out without a face mask, or who said that the vaccine could turn you into an alligator. That was the work of the president, and it's his responsibility." Pedro Halal said that the COVID-19 mortality average was more than four times higher in Brazil than the rest of the world. 2,345 per million of the population in Brazil versus 494 per million of the population globally. Pedro Halal, who last week testified before a Senate inquiry into the government's handling of the crisis, also estimated that 95,000 to 145,000 deaths occurred due to the country's inaction in acquiring vaccines. The inquiry has heard damning evidence that the Brazilian government of President Jair Bolsonaro dismissed several vaccine offers from pharmaceutical companies in 2020, even as the coronavirus raged throughout Brazil. Brazil's vaccination program finally started in late January, but it has been constantly interrupted by shortages of both imported vaccine doses and supplies for the domestic manufacture of CoronaVac vaccines, which requires an active pharmaceutical ingredient shipped in from China. According to figures by a group of media outlets, the program recently gained some momentum with new shipments, including the donation of 3 million doses, and at least one dose has now been given to 33% of Brazil's 212 million citizens. But the program is far from running smoothly. The percentage of Brazilian citizens who are fully vaccinated has remained stuck at under 12% for nearly a month, as millions of Brazilians fail to return for their second dose of the vaccine. The effect of such incomplete treatment remains unclear, but with Brazil still struggling with the P1 variant of the virus, health experts say that many people will need to start their vaccinations again. The reasons for the incomplete vaccination include a shortage of vaccines, a lack of close follow-ups by medical staff, and a failure to launch a national campaign stressing the importance of the second dose of the vaccine. The epidemiologist, Carla Dominguez, said, "We need a national campaign calling people to get fully vaccinated, which did not happen in Brazil." Carla Dominguez, who coordinated a successful national immunization program between 2011 and 2019, said that leadership was critical to its success. Dominguez added, "At the launch of every previous vaccination campaign in Brazil, the president had a vaccine unit encouraging people, but the current president has not appeared at any unit since the beginning of the COVID rollout. On the contrary, Jair Bolsonaro has actively discouraged the campaign, refusing to be vaccinated himself, and spreading falsehoods about immunization. He told supporters back in March about being previously infected by COVID-19. Jair Bolsonaro said, "I've got the virus alive, so I'm immunized." He added, "I will let other people get the injection in my place, and later on, if I decide to get the vaccine, because depending on me, this is voluntary, you cannot force anyone to take it. I will take it." In the meantime, local authorities struggle to keep people engaged in vaccination. The northeastern Brazilian state of Maranhão recently released a campaign offering up to $2,000 for those who get the second dose of the vaccine. however, according to a senior Brazilian politician leading an investigation, the congressional inquiry into Brazil's disastrous response to the coronavirus pandemic has found mounting evidence that Jair Bolsonaro's administration committed crimes against life. Launched in April to scrutinize the government's handling of a crisis that has killed 500,000 Brazilian citizens, the nationally televised investigation is digging into the political decisions that led up to one of the cruelest moments in the country's history. Senator Omar Aziz told the Guardian newspaper, "The most shocking thing is the realization of how negligent the Brazilian government has been on so many issues. Testimony from officials and newly revealed documents are giving Brazilians a clear view of the context in which the government dismissed offers to purchase vaccines in 2020 and failed to respond quickly when oxygen supplies ran out in Manaus, leaving COVID patients to suffocate." The inquiry has also heard evidence that Jair Bolsonaro never wanted to buy COVID-19 vaccines and originally bet on herd immunity to beat the coronavirus. Critics claim that strategy cost many thousands of Brazilian lives. The investigation was launched in April and is being conducted by 11 of the country's 81 senators, including 4 Bolsonaro supporters and several of his most outspoken critics. The panel is expected to release its conclusions by August. It does not have the power to bring criminal charges against Jair Bolsonaro, but the evidence it gathers could be used in future criminal investigations and could also prompt Congress to launch impeachment proceedings against Jair Bolsonaro.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Televised speech on the eve of the 13th presidential election, June 16, 2021. People's duty with regard to the elections, participation in the elections, and what kind of participation. In the Islamic Republic, Republic is one part and Islamic is another. If Republic is not a part of it, then the Islamic Republic will not be realized. On the other hand, there are many political aspects, and the political effects are productive and full of blessings, some of which I will mention later on. This is exactly why all the satanic centers of power in the world, those who oppose and bear animosity towards the Islamic Republic, are particularly against and opposed to the elections. In all our elections over these decades, their media has always been used as a political means to destroy people's mindset toward the elections and to interfere in some way in the elections in order to prevent the splendor and glory of the Iranian elections from being shown. Over these many years, all the elections have been held on time, even if they cannot see this. They haven't been cancelled or postponed even one day. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah. People have come to the ballot boxes and cast their votes. Of course, there has been hostile propaganda this propaganda has always existed before and after the elections. Perhaps there is no other country in the world that can be found whose elections have been attacked by the enemies this much. For this election, which will take place on Friday, the day after tomorrow, the US media, the UK media, and their mercenaries who are working for these media have been working for several months now. They are working very hard in an attempt to try to throw doubt on the elections, downplay people's participation, and make allegations against the elections of the Islamic Republic in some way. They say all different kinds of things in this respect. Well, their goal is for the elections to not to be held as desired by the Islamic Republic. What does this mean? It means that they want the people to distance themselves from the system, because a lack of participation in the elections naturally means people distancing themselves from the Islamic Republic. This is the goal they pursue.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
The limelight.
Theoretically, that nearly $1.3 trillion to be spent on national security writ large is supposed to be devoted to activities that make America and the world a safer place. That's visibly not the case when it comes to so many of the funds that will be expended in the name of national security, from taxpayer dollars thrown away on weapon systems that don't work to those spent on an unnecessary and dangerous new generation of nuclear weapons, to continuing to reinforce and extend the historically unprecedented U.S. military presence on this planet by maintaining more than 800 overseas military bases around the world. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written jointly by Mandy Smith Berger and William Harting, authors. This article is published under the heading U.S. nearly $1.3 trillion national security budget isn't making Americans any safer. Stay tuned for more. We'll be right back. President Biden's first Pentagon budget, released late last month, is staggering by any reasonable standard. At more than $750 billion for Defense Department and related work on nuclear weapons at the Department of Energy, it represents one of the highest levels of spending since the Second World War, far higher than the peaks of the Korean or Vietnam Wars or President Ronald Reagan's military buildup of 1980s, and roughly three times what China spends on its military. Developments of the past year and a half, an ongoing pandemic, and intensifying mega drought, white supremacy activities, and racial and economic injustice among them should have underscored that the greatest threats to American lives are anything but military in nature. But no matter, the Biden administration has decided to double down on military spending as the primary pillar of what still passes for American security policy. And don't be fooled by that striking Pentagon budget figure either. This year's funding request suggests that the total national security budget will come closer to a breathtaking $1.3 trillion. That mind-boggling figure underscores just how misguided Washington's current security, a word that should increasingly be put in quotation marks, policies really are. No less concerning was the new administration's decision to go full speed ahead on long-standing Pentagon plans to build a new generation of nuclear-armed bombers, submarines, and missiles, including, of course, new nuclear warheads to go with them, at a cost of at least $1.7 trillion over the next three decades. In all, Biden's first budget is a major win for key players in the nuclear industrial complex, like Northrop Grumman, the prime contractor on the new nuclear bomber and a new intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, General Dynamics, the maker of the new ballistic missile submarine, Lockheed Martin, which produces sea-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, and firms like Honeywell that oversee the key elements in the Department of Energy's nuclear warhead complex. The Pentagon's proposed base budget, which in the past year has included routine spending for fighting ongoing conflicts, was $715 billion for the fiscal year 2022, $10 billion more than last year's request. Despite complaints to the contrary by advocates of even higher Pentagon spending, that represents no small addition. It's larger, for instance, than the entire budget of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. No question about it, the Pentagon remains by a long shot the agency with the largest discretionary budget. As for what's in the base budget, there are a number of particularly troubling proposed expenditures that warrant attention and congressional pushback. Spending on the Pentagon's new intercontinental ballistic missile, known formally as the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, has nearly doubled in the new proposal from $1.4 billion to $2.6 billion. This may seem like small change in such a budget, but it's just a down payment on a system that could, in the end, cost more than $100 billion to procure and another $164 billion to operate over its lifetime. More importantly, as former Secretary of Defense William Perry noted, ICBMs are some of the most dangerous weapons in the world because a president would have only a matter of minutes to decide whether to launch them upon a warning of an attack, greatly increasing the risk of an accidental nuclear war based on a false alarm. In short, The new ICBM is not just costly, but exceedingly dangerous for the health of humanity. The Biden budget should have eliminated it, not provided more funding for it. Another eye-opener is the decision to spend more than $12 billion on the F-35 combat aircraft, a troubled, immensely expensive weapons system whose technical flaws suggest that it may never be fully ready for combat. Such knowledge should, of course, have resulted in a decision to at least pause production on the plane until testing is complete. House Armed Services Committee Chair Adam Smith has stated that he's tired of pouring money down the F-35 rat hole, while the Air Force's top officer, General Charles Brown, has compared it to a Ferrari that you don't drive to work every day, but only drive it out on Sundays. Consider that an embarrassing admission for a plane once publicized as a future low-cost bulwark for the U.S. combat aircraft fleet. Whether the Air Force, Navy, and Marines, the three services that utilize variants of F-35 will stay the course and buy more than 2,400 of these aircraft remains to be seen. Count on one thing, though. The F-35 lobby, including a special F-35 caucus in the House of Representatives, and the Machinist Union, whose workers build the planes, will fight tooth and nail to keep the program fully funded, regardless of whether or not it serves national security needs. And keep in mind that the F-35 is only one of the many legacies of failed Pentagon modernization efforts. Even if the Pentagon were to acquire its new systems without delays or cost overruns, something rare indeed, its expensive spending plans have already earned this decade the moniker of the terrible 20s. Worse yet, there is a distinct possibility that Congress will push that budget even higher in response to wish lists being circulated by each of the military services. Items on them that have yet to make it into the Biden Pentagon budget include things like, surprise, more F-35s. The Army's wish list even includes systems it claimed it needed to cut. That the services are even allowed to make such requests to Congress is symbolic of a breakdown in budgetary discipline of the highest order. The base budget also includes mandatory spending for items like military retirement. This year's request adds $12.8 billion to the Pentagon's tab. Theoretically, that nearly $1.3 trillion to be spent on national security writ large is supposed to be devoted to activities that make America and the world a safer place. That's visibly not the case. When it comes to so many of the funds that will be expended in the name of national security, from taxpayer dollars thrown away on weapon systems that don't work, to those spent on an unnecessary and dangerous new generation of nuclear weapons, to continuing to reinforce and extend the historically unprecedented U.S. military presence on this planet by maintaining more than 800 overseas military bases around the world. Unfortunately, unlike the proposed Pentagon budget, significant Green New Deal-style infrastructure funding is far less likely to be passed by a bitterly divided Congress. Washington evidently doesn't care that such investments would also be significantly more effective job creators. Sadly, though, too many of America's political leaders have clearly drawn the wrong lessons from the pandemic. If this country continues to squander staggering sums on narrowly focused national security activities at a time when greatest challenges are anything but military nature, this country and the world will be a far less safe place in the future.
Spotlight.
After nearly two decades, the U.S. military has pulled out of Afghanistan's main military base, Bagram Airfield, near Kabul. The withdrawal is expected to be the beginning of the end of the U.S. war, which turned out to be its longest, leaving thousands of civilians dead. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the importance of the latest U.S. move, and we'll try to figure out what Washington and its allies have achieved from the war.
American and NATO forces have finally left Afghanistan's Bagram Air Base, the hub of the U.S. military operations in the country for nearly 20 years. The pullout marks a symbolic end to what U.S. President Joe Biden has called Washington's forever war. It comes after Biden announced earlier this year his decision to withdraw all U.S. forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The pullout has been welcomed by the Afghan people.
This is good news that the Americans left Bagram. The Americans had reached an agreement with the Taliban in Doha, and these agreements must be implemented. And this is for the good of Afghanistan.
God willing, there will be peace in this country. We want peace until the end. God is merciful, and we hope that one day there will be peace in our country.
The Taliban militant group has also welcomed the withdrawal as a positive step. The group's spokesman said the full withdrawal of foreign forces will pave the way for Afghans to decide about their future themselves. In February 2020, the administration of former President Donald Trump struck a deal with the Taliban to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 2021. Joe Biden rescheduled the date and set September 11th for the pullout. The U.S. and its NATO allies invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 under the pretext of the so-called War on Terror. The Taliban militant group was removed from power following the invasion. However, after nearly two decades, the U.S. invasion failed to uproot the militant group, and Washington had to finally sit at the negotiating table with the group. According to the Pentagon, the U.S. military operations in Afghanistan have cost nearly $825 billion. Also, according to U.S. media reports, more than 2,400 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Afghanistan. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has left thousands of Afghan civilians dead and caused a significant damage to the country's infrastructure. And now, with the prospect of an end to the war, which, though failed to bring security to the country, calls will certainly get louder for the prosecution of American troops and officials involved in the war crimes against the Afghan people.
Well, joining us on this edition of the Spotlight, we have Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who's joining us from San Francisco. Also, we have journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas, who's with us from the British capital, London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Becker in San Francisco. Mr. Becker, tell us how significant this withdrawal from the Bagram Air Base is, in your opinion.
Well, it's very significant in that, as was said in your lead, Bagram has been the hub of U.S. war efforts there. We also have to remember that Bagram is a torture center. That's not talked about very much now, but people died there under torture and suffered terribly under torture by CIA and other U.S. operatives. Bagram has been the symbol of the U.S., the latest U.S. intervention. And, you know, do have to point out that the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan once before. It wasn't the open armed forces as it is now. But the CIA operation that began in 1979 ended only with the fall of the Soviet Union, which was in 1991. And during that 12 years, the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, which was the largest CIA intervention ever up until that point, and maybe up to this point, created the conditions for the terrible conditions that plague Afghanistan down till today, and with this latest withdrawal of U.S. forces. Of course, we don't know what the disposition is of, in addition to the U.S. forces, the many thousands of mercenary troops, contractors, who are in Afghanistan and from the United States and from other countries who are being paid by the Pentagon.
Mr. Abbas, symbolically, this does represent something significant, but what about the immediate impact of the withdrawal? As we know, Bagram is strategically vital and important, too.
Well, the immediate impact will be that the Taliban will, reckon that the Americans are getting serious about leaving, because, of course, there's been a huge upsurge in takeover of various provincial areas by the Taliban as soon as they heard that Biden was planning to not leave till September of 2021. So it does seem as there's been a lot of activity, a lot of terror attacks, and a lot of movement in various provinces by the Taliban forces. In fact, what we've seen is Afghan government forces literally surrendering without much of a fight in many, many areas. And immediate impact could be that the Taliban would refrain from launching further attacks, perhaps. The Americans may be hoping for that. But, of course, the overview of this war is that at its peak, the US and NATO military numbers surpassed 150,000. I think they're looking at something like 6,500 to be there now. Goodness knows what it'll be in reality by the time they actually leave. The conflict has cost America more than $2 trillion, according to a Brown University analysis, and more than 2,500 American servicemen members were killed. I mean, a lot more than that probably by now. These are figures from maybe a year or two back. But along with scores of allied troops, humanitarian workers, journalists, and tens of thousands of civilians, these have all been casualties of war. And let's not even begin to mention the number of Afghans that have been killed. I mean, it's diabolical, the kind of American terror which has been inflicted on the ordinary Afghan civilians, whether it's through drone attacks or whether it's through operations. It's been an absolutely disgusting and dirty war. Of course, we've also seen the death of Donald Rumsfeld, who presided over the beginning of this war. Nobody's going to be remembering Donald Rumsfeld with any glee in Afghanistan. But Biden's decision to withdraw troops from Afghanistan's consistent with his view over the last 20 years about the war. I mean, he has been negative about it, although under Obama they did continue the war. It seems as though now, finally, the Americans are going to pull out, but they're also immediately trying to engineer bases surrounding Afghanistan. Particularly Pakistan has been approached, and Imran Khan, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, categorically said, absolutely not. We won't be allowing American bases to do any kind of work in Afghanistan. And his argument was pretty sound. He said if the Americans could not bring peace and prosperity to Afghanistan while they had boots on the ground in the nation, how on earth are they going to do it from outside? So the immediate impact, of course, will have reverberations on Pakistan, on Iran, on Russia, on all the bordering powers that exist there. All of these regional powers will now be looking to see how they can influence what goes on in Afghanistan if an American withdrawal becomes total.
Richard Becker, the initial deadline was set in September, but there are talks of a full troop withdrawal by even as early as July 4th. Why is this all happening at such a rapid pace?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, for one thing, there is a shift that's going on an overall shift. Not that the U.S. is leaving the Middle East or leaving South Asia, but it's reorienting its military toward Asia, the pivot to Asia, and the extreme and growing hostility toward the People's Republic of China. If you follow to any extent the military websites, every day there's a discussion about new weaponry to be used against China and, you know, this all-domain plans of warfare and so forth. But you can see that that this shift is going on. There's some really amazing things about this, that the U.S. is withdrawing its troops and the Afghan army and the Afghan National Police, in some places, according to today's New York Times, in some provinces of Afghanistan, the troops are surrendering because they have no ammunition. They're out of ammunition. And this is after trillions of dollars have been spent. The level, in other words, the level of corruption is so high. The Times report also includes a reference to a poker game where it said, in Kabul, where it said that sometimes $120,000 is on the table. I mean, so this, where did the money go? Why is there so little improvement for the people? Why would the Afghan army not have ammunition? I mean, it's because it's the money has gone somewhere else. So we see this tremendously corrupt intervention that's taken place, and the corruption continues. And, you know, we will see whether or not there is the kind of collapse that many in Afghanistan are anticipating.
Mr. Abbas, let's talk about some of the reactions to the withdrawal. Russia said that this should not turn into a redeployment of NATO military infrastructure in Central Asia. Do you think that Moscow has a point here? Maybe down the line, U.S. and NATO will assume that they should come back to Afghanistan.
It's entirely possible. It's such a kind of linchpin in terms of geostrategic value to all of the powers in that region. Let's start with China. I mean, we're talking about Russia, but the Eurasian axis, which China and Russia, as well as Iran, are very much a central part of course, also Pakistan, would all be impacted by whatever goes on in Afghanistan, because the roots of the Silk Road, if you like, or the Belt Road Initiative, do need to also pass through Afghanistan. So, of course, not only from a geo-military perspective, but also from a geo-economic perspective, Afghanistan is hugely important. And so I think that we're going to see the Americans, whilst they say they're moving out, they do have bases dotted around, I think, in various regions there. They can still cause trouble. And we know already the Russians are probably speaking on the back of intelligence, which tells them that the Americans have already flown in ISIS recruits. So ISIS, much of the ISIS forces that were pushed out of Iraq or Syria, have been redeployed already in Afghanistan. So although the American military is pulling out, there's nothing to say that they can't use their Takfiri mercenaries in Afghanistan and that region. So, yes, it's entirely possible that the Americans won't leave totally. It's said that 650 U.S. troops will remain supposedly to safeguard embassies and other diplomatic staff in Kabul. The Taliban have responded saying they've got a right to react if the U.S. keeps troops in Afghanistan after September the 11th at all. So any troops are left after September the 11th, they give themselves the right to do what they think is necessary. Read into that what you like. I mean, those bases that they're trying to redeploy were very publicly rebuffed, as I mentioned, by Imran Khan, and Pakistan certainly doesn't want to get involved in supporting American intrusion. Of course, Pakistan, on the quiet, has at one hand been a partner of the U.S. and received funding for its war on terror, or so-called war on terror. But they, at the same time, have also been the primary backers of the Taliban. So Pakistan has a huge interest in Afghanistan. Its primary purpose was to make sure that the Indians weren't left behind as the proxy, if you like, force on behalf of the Americans. They had 30 or so consulates, the Indians in Afghanistan at one point. So clearly something was going on, but the Indians, who are American allies, would dearly like to surround Pakistan on two fronts. So Pakistan has a huge say in this issue, and the Russians, of course, are going to be keeping a very wily eye. Iran, which is allied to Russia in many ways in terms of geopolitics of that region, and allied to China, will also have a major say. Traditionally, Iran has supported the Shia in the western part of Afghanistan. They've also, the Dari speakers were very close to the Persian culture, the Iranian culture, I should say, and also they've had traditional links with the Northern Alliance. So the people who are in power at the moment, Iran has fairly good relations with them. So one would imagine that there's going to be some negotiating to do, but the Americans look like the way they're withdrawing so suddenly, want civil war. Perhaps there will be civil war. This is the danger.
Mr. Becker, what did the 20-year war cost the U.S., not just in terms of the money spent, but logistically, and of course, the human cost, troops and civilians both? What did it cost, and what did they achieve in return?
Well, the cost in human lives has been enormous, and human suffering. And that has been, of course, very disproportionately on the side of the Afghan people. I believe the UN didn't start keeping track of civilian deaths until 2009, and they as of a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, they had recorded that there were 110,000 civilians who had been killed. I think that tens of thousands of Taliban have been killed, tens of thousands of military forces, Afghan National Police and Army. And I think that the estimates are all low. I think they're all very low. I think that, we hear it's 2,400 or so U.S. deaths and 20,000 and some wounded. But I think there are just tens of thousands. The 775 or 800,000 U.S. troops served at one time, and many of those multiple deployments. And I think that many of the injuries, psychological and physical injuries, have gone undiagnosed. And I think that goes for all sides. So I think there's a huge underestimate of the number of TBI, of traumatic brain injuries, of PTSD, the rate of violence for people coming back to the U.S., soldiers coming back has been quite high, the rate of suicides has been quite high, and then all the damage that's been done to Afghanistan, immense amounts of bombing and destruction of civilian infrastructure. It would be built and destroyed and built and destroyed. So it's a terrible war. It's been a terrible war. It's been a terrible war for everyone who's been involved in it, and particularly, as you said, for the people of Afghanistan. It's been an unmitigated disaster.
And Mr. Abbas, regarding the civilian deaths, the ICC, they tried to pursue an investigation into the civilian casualties, but they were met with staunch opposition from Washington. Will there, in your opinion, be accountability for the victims and justice for their families?
If you look at the track record of American interventions across West Asia in particular, whether it's their gains in Syria that caused millions of deaths, or whether it's the Libyan fiasco, which is still ongoing with the actual disaster that they caused there, whether you look at Iraq and the millions that have died, suffered, been left homeless and as refugees, etc., there's been no accountability for any of these folk. There's no accountability for the people who have been put in Guantanamo Bay, for instance. I think there's only 70 or so inmates left there, but of the 700 that were there, there's been no real justice for any of these folk. The Americans see themselves as above international law. Under Donald Trump, you saw that very starkly. They didn't feel it was a problem in any shape or form. They haven't been brought to account for their clear and open murder, assassination, or I call it extrajudicial killing of a major figure like Lieutenant General Soleimani. So figures who were killed openly in broad daylight, America doesn't get brought to task there. I shouldn't imagine that the kind of Afghan families that they've been bombing with their drones and various other weapons of mass destruction will have the kind of political weight to be able to get any kind of recourse to justice. We know what the Americans did at Abu Ghraib, in the prisons there in Iraq. But what's happened in Afghanistan has been buried a lot more deeply because the way they've been killing them has always been touted as killing of terrorists. And of course, the whole world was on this, the whole secular Western imperialist world was on this bandwagon of the so-called war of terror. It was really a war of terror on the people of West Asia, Afghanistan, onwards. That's what it was all about. America is suffering defeat upon defeat in the region, though. The encouragement for the people of that region is that the axis of resistance is putting up a really strong resistance. The Taliban itself, although I don't think it's part of the axis of resistance, they also, with the backing of Pakistan, I believe, done a pretty good job at making it very hard for the Americans to get anything out of Afghanistan. It's been an unmitigated disaster, an absolute defeat. They've not achieved any of the targets they set out for. Perhaps they got some funding out of the narcotics that they were smuggling through various channels out of the nation. Perhaps they got their hands on some of the riches that Afghanistan possesses, but it's very hard to extract most of the minerals and the multi-trillion dollar wealth that Afghanistan actually has. It's an awfully difficult area, and of course, if you've got a war going on, you can't do it either. So perhaps that's another one of the reasons that they've not been getting the economic return that they wanted out of Afghanistan, which has led them to withdraw temporarily or leave altogether. We don't know. That's not something that's written in stone. So I think never count your chickens before they hatch, as they say, and the Americans haven't left, leaving Bagram Airport. They seem to have the Turks and Erdogan wanting to come in and run the airport. He seems awfully keen on coming and doing some of NATO's work there. That's something I would be very unadvisable for him, because the Taliban have already issued warnings saying to the Turks that, look, keep your business out of Afghanistan. Otherwise, you too may go the same way as the Americans.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests.